Deutsche Welle. Living Planet.
From DW Studios in Bonn, this is Living Planet, and I'm Charlotte Lomas. Coming up on today's show, why parasite wasps could aid food production. We go on a magical mystery tour of kale, and how chocolate dreams really can come true. That's coming up here on Living Planet. Stay tuned. We start the show in northwest Kenya, where for about a half a million people, food is scarce. There, severe drought has devastated crops and people are dying from malnutrition. And yet, according to the Kenyan government, the region still doesn't qualify for emergency relief. People are left to fend for themselves and rely on the charity of others. Linda Stauder has more and Louise Osborne presents her report.
In the tiny village of Konyaru in West Pokot County, a province in northwestern Kenya, the sun relentlessly blazes down on corrugated iron roofs. Goats roam the paths between red shacks while chickens scrape in the dirt. In the middle of the village, a group of old men have found shelter on a sandy patch in the shade of a big tree. They are the village elders, at least 60 years old, some well into their 80s. They're all so skinny that you can see their bones.
We've been starving for 4 years in a row now. You can't rely on regular rainfall anymore, and it doesn't rain enough for us to grow anything.
That's Lomeri Akachu. He's one of the Pokot people who mainly live off livestock breeding. Cows, goats and camels traditionally provide milk, meat and a modest living. But his people also grow corn, beans and a few vegetables.
Everything was going okay with our crops. But then everything suddenly changed. We used to have enough rain and enough to eat for our families. But now all we have is drought.
That's Chesi Matia, one of the village elders. All you can see on the cornfields around him are a few spindly stalks. The rest of the crop has withered. It's a sad sight sitting between the succulent green bushes and trees. Last week it finally rained, but it was already too late for the farmers.
So when these rains are coming now after a month, it is only coming to water the grass because there is no crops again in the field. We are not sure whether the rains are going to continue. And if the rains stop continuing, in just 2-3 days, the environment will have gone back to a situation where we are actually going to say it's bad.
Titus Lote, Deputy Governor of West Pokot, estimates that almost 200,000 people in the region are starving. For another 250,000 people, food is scarce. They don't get any help from the Kenyan capital, Nairobi. Ironically, the late rain of all things has destroyed any hope of that.
It is green in most areas. This county has never reached a drought stage. The worst of it is called emergency. The stage that we are currently in is normal. We don't get relief supplies when we are not in stress.
And Lote is right. Gabriel Magobo works for the National Drought Management Authority. He's responsible for emergency relief in the areas of Kenya deemed to be worst affected by hunger and starvation. And he says West Pokot is not one of them.
If crop fails year in, year out in your place, then that is your normal. And you are used to surviving with it. Crop failure is not drought. Crop failure is not hunger. And hunger is not famine.
It's possible that Philip Uwe Pale, the local administrator of the region around Konyaru, finds that view cynical. 5 people have already died from malnutrition in this village alone. Hunger is slowly but surely becoming the new norm, he says.
We have experienced a lot of drought, almost 6 years here. The climate have really changed. They are really affected people so much. People are living in their homes without food. The few people who have cows, all the cows migrated to Uganda.
In Uganda, there's still food and water, But most of the strong men, young women and children have already left Konyaaru, taking their animals with them. Without the herds, those left behind have no milk or meat to replace the dried out crop.
If your animals are gone, then you're done. We have nothing left.
Says village elder Lumeri Akachu, his face wears a bitter look. Behind him, a neighbour tries to soothe her nephew. The toddler screams because he's hungry until the grandmother gives him her empty breasts. The toddler still doesn't have any food, but the suckling calms him down. Titus Lote, deputy governor of West Poco, says the children suffer most from the drought.
Children are actually suffering a lot, and the elderly people are suffering a lot. But in this county also, it's important to mention that women are also suffering a lot. On the basis that women are the ones that are supposed to get food from the field, they're the ones that are supposed to cook for the family, and they're the ones that eat last. That is, if there's any food that remains.
A few steps away, Cheponyurio sits in front of her shack. The old woman has to take care of her frail husband alone, as their three grown-up children have left home.
We are dependent on our children finding casual work elsewhere so they can support us. That's how we survive.
The nearest food market is a long way away. Getting there over the rough streets is expensive and tedious. And there is never enough money for anybody to feel full.
Food is politics,
says Titus Lote. The hungry in West Poco are being ignored by national authorities.
Because they've got a lot of money from donors and from the national government to transform this area into a non-food aid reliant county. And because that money has done nothing, they have to justify to the donors, to the national government, that they have done something. So they are justifying actions that have failed. They will say there is no need of food. That's the worst crime I can say. I call it a crime.
The provincial government has started taking action and distributed sacks of corn and beans at their own expense using money that was supposed to go towards development of the poor region. But the supplies won't last for long.
We tried to get the attention of the government, but no one is listening to us.
Village elder Lumeri Akachu lowers his eyes to the ground. Like most people here in Konyaaru, he has given up hope.
Louise Osborne ending that report by Linda Staude. Like in Kenya, climate change presents challenges for farmers and food security right across the globe. That's why experts are working hard to find ways to adapt farming methods to ensure future food production. At an urban farm in the heart of downtown Ottawa, Canada, scientists are carrying out research aimed at helping farmers increase their yields. Sean Griffiths visited the Central Experimental Farm, Ottawa's big outdoor laboratory, and filed this report.
Researchers from the Hubei Academy of Agriculture Sciences in China are touring the farm with Dr. Gavin Humphreys, a plant breeder who specializes in developing resilient wheat. Dr. Humphreys' latest research has been on Fusarium head blight, deadly to wheat and other crops like barley. In field 6, he compares two heads of wheat.
Instead of the spike being completely green, it's only about one-third of it is green. The top two-thirds are all yellow. They've all been basically infected with the fungus, and they will not make bread or anything.
He breeds varieties increasingly resistant to the fungus by gradually weeding out the most susceptible plants.
And when we'll need to move, or we're going to get wet.
Fusarium fungus decimates about 5% of Canada's wheat crop, worth about $5 billion Canadian, or 3.5 billion euros annually. Fusarium is all too familiar to Chinese researchers like Dan Dan Chin.
Especially in the region alongside the Yangtze River, because the weather is more humid than the other region, so it is very helpful for this disease. It also affects the yield and the quality of wheat negatively.
Which means China faces problems feeding its people. What kinds of foods is wheat used for in China?
Noodle, bread, and also dumpling.
Dr. Wen Cao, originally from China, now works at the farm. He says it just wouldn't be possible to conduct this kind of important research in a living outdoor laboratory like this in the middle of Beijing, China's capital city.
No, never happened that in China. China's so many people there.
There's no room,
definitely.
First question everybody asks, is it going to sting me?
On the edge of a farm is a quarantined unit.
Parasitic wasps are a completely different group than bees or wasps or hornets. These things do not sting humans. They're very small. Relative to a honeybee, they're probably, about the quarter of the size? And they're not interested in humans. They're interested in the insect that they're trying to attack.
Dr. Peter Mason specializes in biological control, finding good bugs to tackle the bad ones which wreak havoc on plants, crops, and trees. As the world becomes more globalized, it's not just human beings who are traveling around the world. Increasingly, insects are too, away from their natural habitat and away from their natural predators. This is the case with the leek moth, which first appeared here 20 years ago. It's native to Europe. Due to a lack of natural predators, it has been able to devastate leek, garlic, and other onion crops.
You know, there are probably several hundred leek moth larvae here. They're probably about a half an inch long. They mine into the internal leaf tissue, and basically they just eat it from the inside out. And of course, you know, you wouldn't want to buy a leek that looks like that in the market.
He's been exploring how to control the leek moth for 10 years. This parasitic wasp establishes itself inside the leek moth pupa before it has a chance to reach maturity.
They will bend their abdomen and insert their ovipositor into the end of the pupa, and they will then put an egg inside. The pupa dies, the leek moth pupa, it's gone, it's dead.
5 years ago, after rigorous testing to ensure the parasitic wasp targeted only the leek moth, the wasp was released. It's still early days, but so far it's showing promise as it establishes itself among the leek moth population. The leek moth is just one of the many bad bugs Dr. Mason is trying to control. Meanwhile, over in Field 6, Dr. Malcolm Morrison is conducting soybean research. Up until the mid-1970s, soybean was uncommon in Canada, except in southern Ontario, as the colder climate and the longer daylight hours in summer didn't suit the crop. But scientists at the Central Experimental Farm figured out how to make soybean grow in other parts of Canada where it didn't grow before. Soybean is now worth hundreds of millions of dollars to Canadian farmers. Now Dr. Morrison is trying to assess the impact of climate change on this lucrative crop. Although Canada is known for its hostile winters, forecasts show it's due to be drier during the summer, the key growing season meaning more drought.
It's great for the drought tolerance work. You can tell the differences between the irrigated ones and the non-irrigated ones just by looking at them.
The more drought-resistant soybean are, the more available this highly nutritious crop will be as food, even in adverse climate conditions.
I think that soybean is an excellent crop to feed people because it has a very high protein content, upwards of 42-44% protein. And the protein is a very high quality protein. So you have a good protein source, you have good oil, and oil is an essential energy component.
And when Dr. Morrison is in the middle of his field, he forgets that he's actually in the middle of the city.
To be quite honest, when I'm out here, I divorce myself from all the buildings, and all I see is my field. I don't really see the cars and that. To the men and women who work on this farm, I think it's really nice that we can, you know, live in and get all the benefits of a city and then get all the benefits of working on an experimental farm.
For Dr. Humphreys, who comes from a line of farmers, time spent at the farm is far from a recreational pursuit. It's about feeding the world.
9 billion people, and by 2050, we have to continue to increase yields and produce high quality for everyone.
Shan Griffiths for DW at the Central Experimental Farm in Ottawa.
We'll be right back.
From the farm to the table, for the second half of the show, we go on a fun-filled foodie tour. And we start with kale. Now, I know what you're thinking, pretty boring. But kale is one of the most talked about vegetables on the planet. It's one of these so-called superfoods, so it's packed with all kinds of nutrients. Well, here in Germany, this leafy green vegetable is so popular, there's even a season named after it. In Bremen, our reporter Louise Gorman went for a journey along the kale trail.
Anyone who lives with a northern German will attest, when it comes to kale, there's no curbing the enthusiasm.
Honey, it's ready.
Mmm,
so good.
In kitchens and villages in and around the boggy marshes of Bremen and Oldenburg, this curly-leafed green cabbage has been an important staple in winter diets for centuries.
This was one of the few vegetables that could grow here, and it was very nourishing, so that's why it was eaten a lot in the earlier days, and we just still love it today.
That's Gabriela Duva from Oldenburg's Tourism and Marketing Office. Her colleagues are determined to turn kale into a golden currency, creating an academy to educate tourists on the ritual of the season, which runs from October through to March. Here in Oldenburg, the humble green cabbage has made its way into condiments such as pesto, mustard, and even tea. Duva says nobility in the former fiefdom is inextricably linked to modern-day customs.
The Duke of Oldenburg liked to go or to travel out into the landscape and eat kale there. So one day, the Oldenburger Turnerbund did a tour into the landscape as well, and they went into a restaurant, and all that was left was the kale from the day before, and they ate this kale, and they liked it so much that they started this tradition of doing this every year.
That gymnastics club legacy nearly 150 years ago is what's known today as a Kohlfahrt. To avoid any misunderstandings, Kohl means cabbage in German, and Fahrt in this context, a walk or tour. Back in familiar territory in the Hanseatic city of Bremen, it's a Saturday, and I'm on the kale trail. Not far along the North Country Road, I spy a group of ladies milling around a bus stop. Tiny porcelain beer mugs and other paraphernalia dangle from their necks.
I just say, you look all fantastic. What are you carrying here? You have...
We have pretzels, we have cheese, we have a bit of salami. Sausage, yes, yeah. Sausage, yeah. Of course, something to drink. It's very important for the way.
Yeah.
Most important thing ever.
They're pulling a wooden cart or Bollerwagen, stacked with bottled water, coffee, and importantly, as 51-year-old Martina reveals, a secret cachet of flavoured vodka.
Something like this.
Okay. Mm. And this is the sour power and
yes.
The lady power.
Lady power.
One time every season, or is it as many times as possible?
No. No, it's just once a year and most likely end of January or in February.
Just the thought of drinking seems to have made these cabbage trippers giddy. Over the road, I find myself lured to the music coming from a slightly younger group of couples huddled around a cart that is more beast than Bollerwagen.
Pimp up my Bollerwagen, sozusagen.
Complete with flashing lights, sirens, beer holders, flags, and a loud boombox, this custom-made cart was the first of its kind a decade ago. These days, I'm told, a sound system is a standard extra on upmarket models for hire.
How will you walk today, do you know?
For about 3 hours, more or less.
Okay, well, you're going to work for your food.
But it's a secret. We didn't know where we have to go.
First games?
Maybe.
First games.
These old chums are soon inducting me into their weird cabbage subculture. A necklace with a shot glass is hung around my neck and a fluorescent green liquid appears. In between pours, Clemens, my unofficial kale tour guide, tries to impart the rules.
Because normally you have to drink at each corner.
Yeah.
Each corner where you cross, you have to drink a schnapps. So...
A strong coffee and I head north to the foggy moors west of Oldenburg. Erwin Abel has been running the Bummerstädter Krug with his wife Hilly for years, a family-owned tavern that opened 125 years ago. And it's not just the 67-year-old who thinks their brand of cabbage is so special. Abel says the German capital requests hundreds of bottled kale each year to feed mostly politicians at an annual event showcasing Niedersachsen culture.
Kale is delivered from our house since 26 years, and I think they are content with it for 26 years.
In the kitchen, I find Nico Winkelmann stirring an enormous vat of kale stew with a spoon easily a meter long. The 31-year-old head chef explains the ingredients on top of the already dozens of kilos of washed frozen cabbage leaves and up to 30 liters of water.
The usual recipe consists of 40 kilos of kale and then you add roughly 10 kilos of onions, several stalks of meat juices and then you add your oat groats and mustard. When it's all cooked together, it amounts to around 100 kilos.
Alongside a generous helping of roasted potatoes and a smorgasbord of smoked pork offerings, two kinds of sausages, including Pinkelwurst, a regional delicacy containing pork and barley, and et voilà, kohl and pinkel. Of course, cabbage is not the only thing on the menu, Abel says, but many find it difficult to resist.
Even when guests plan to eat from the menu, then in the end, many of them end up saying, oh, I think maybe I will have kale tonight too.
Tonight, the first of 250 guests have begun flooding the corridors of this converted farmhouse. They have been on a cabbage tour organized by a local firm. Happy but slightly disorientated, they appear in urgent need of a bathroom. I bump into Melanie and Ulf. With their heavy golden-like necklaces, they stand out in the crowd. Colleagues by day, tonight they hold the title of Kale King and Queen, having led their 120-strong contingent to their rightful destination.
It's a very nice time, so you have 1 year time to organize everything. And my king is the best, everything is fine.
It's really an honor. It's an honor to organize a kofa party for a whole company.
As I try to finish even half of my king-size portion, my thoughts turn to the novelty and occasion of it all. Dancing and partying the night away, all in the name of one cabbage. Louise Gorman for DW.
Not convinced by the Germans' love for kale? Well, perhaps you're more of a sweet tooth. Next, we meet two office workers who quit their jobs and made a life-changing decision to become chocolatiers in Vietnam. What might have started as a midlife crisis quickly turned into sweet success. Today they're exporting prize-winning chocolate bars around the world. It seems hard to believe, doesn't it? Well, Lena Bordewein travelled to Vietnam for a taste, and Helen Sini presents this report.
The road to chocolate is paved with adventure. Samuel Maruta drives through the insane traffic of Ho Chi Minh City in a 40-year-old Citroën without a seatbelt or windshield. He swerves around the corner into a shabby industrial district, zipping through the maze of streets until he ends up in front of a slightly damaged sliding gate, coloured mint green. Behind this gate lies a Vietnamese success story, one that sounds almost like a fairy tale. Once upon a time, two disillusioned office workers, a Franco-Japanese banker and a Franco-American advertising executive, met on a soul-searching trip through the Vietnamese jungle. They discovered a shared passion, chocolate, and set out together by motorbike to find their fortune.
By the time we knew nothing, we knew absolutely nothing. You know, just very basic knowledge on cacao And so it was funny, we'd stop by the side of the road and we'd see something. Oh, is that cacao? And we get close and we're like, no, sorry, it's a coffee tree. It smells like jasmine, it's a coffee tree. So we would get back on the motorbike and continue onward.
They met Mr. Duke, a cacao farmer. And when he sold them their first sack of cacao, they realized they'd stumbled upon a treasure.
That's an extraordinary thing, is the first farmer we found was a good farmer. And good farmers are not very common. You know, I mean, we're doing good quality work with cacao, are not common. So we got quite lucky to have, because if we had bought from another farmer who was doing good cacao, we would have maybe been discouraged right away, you know. But we had something that was encouraging and also very unique. He's still the only farmer that we work with in Barrio.
With that discovery, they wrote their manifesto. Maru Chocolate, named by combining their two last names, Maru and Maruta, would be about quality, not quantity. And Maru would be produced in Vietnam, with Vietnamese ingredients. The more natural, the better. And above all, they wouldn't forget that sense of adventure. With that, the two men got started. They hijacked an agricultural course given by a German agronomist from the German Development Organization. They picked up a bean grinder in an Indian store in Singapore. And they managed to dig up an 80-year-old coffee roaster on eBay.
We bought it from this old French woman who had seen her parents buy it new in 1937.
They built the rest of the necessary equipment themselves and in 2011 started their company. 5 years later, their warehouse is full of 10 tons of cocoa beans in burlap sacks, all stamped with their logo. The beans come from small farms all over Vietnam, from the Mekong Delta to the highlands. Each sack is tested for quality. Today, a huge bean roaster is in full operation, running at 110 degrees Celsius. The beans are then peeled and further prepared by hand. And then 13 conch machines blend and agitate the chocolate for up to 48 hours. Finally, a chocolate maker pours the mixture into shape, knocks out the air bubbles. And the end result is wrapped by hand. The finished product sits on the shelf like so many gold bars, thick and shiny. A real treasure.
At the moment, we produce about 100 kilos of chocolate per day. We export roughly 70% of it, and it goes to Europe, North America, Australia, Japan, Korea, so many different markets.
Based on the origin of its cocoa beans, every bar gets its own special packaging. Green, yellow, red or blue, all beautifully decorated with an Art Nouveau style. And then there are the special bars.
Treasure Island and Heart of Darkness come from one farm only. And that farm has amazing cacao. And this cacao comes from... The farm is on an island. The island is in the middle of the Mekong River.
In other words, a treasure island. And the taste... simply amazing.
Helen Sini presented that report by Lena Bordovine. And that wraps up our Foodies special for this week. Thanks to our studio team, Eunice Wanjiro and Thomas Schmidt. If you'd like to listen to more of Living Planet, you can download the Living Planet podcast on iTunes or visit our website at dw.com/environment. I'm Charlotta Lomas. Catch you next week.